Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I had this really unusual, like, outlier house, and it was good. So it sort of helped me get into another stage of work where I was really more interested in pleasure and expression than I had for a long time, which is part of what got me into architecture in the first place, to be honest. I really loved like a lot of kooky, like I loved Oliver Aalto and some of the crazy Japanese architects from the 80s when I first got into architecture. And so it kind of got me back in touch with like what I loved about this profession in the first place, which is sort of inventive making of things and, you know, playing around with spaces.
Hi everyone, I'm Jamie.
I'm Amy, and this is Clever. And today we're talking to Barbara Bester of Bester Architecture. She's been practicing architecture since she founded her studio in 1995, and she's known for experimental residences like the home of Beastie Boy Mike D and the rejuvenation of a couple of historic Lautner houses, and dynamic workplaces like Beats by Dre, Nasty Gal, and Snap.
And hip hospitality, including Instagram darling Intelligentsia Coffee and Ashes and Diamonds Winery. She also teaches regularly at leading architecture universities while running her practice, authoring a book, giving talks, and raising two kids. She has all the qualifications of a true badass. So let's talk to Barbara.
My name is Barbara Bester. I am based in Los Angeles, and I'm an architect building experimental modern projects. I've wanted to be an architect since I was a kid, and I just like thinking about and building different kinds of environments for people. I guess I'm people-oriented, and I think architecture is the best way to, you know, do stuff for people.
So I'd like to go back to the beginning and learn a little bit more about where you grew up and what your family was like, and maybe paint the picture of your childhood for us.
Sure. I grew up in Cambridge, Massachusetts. When I was born, my dad was a grad student in anthropology, and my mom was a German emigre who had moved to the U.S. in 1962 to marry my dad when they were both very, very young. I really liked Cambridge, where I grew up. A lot of people of different kind of walks of life were there. It was more of a college town environment. There wasn't really a lot of money around. That kind of came later with biotech industry. But at the time, it was fairly diverse. My first elementary school was a brand new brutalist elementary school called Tobin Elementary in Cambridge, and we also coincided with the beginning of busing and all kinds of other stuff, which in where I was in Cambridge was not a big deal. I mean, in that there wasn't opposition to it. It was embraced, I think. But anyhow, so it was sort of an interesting, diverse child education in a very, like one of those kind of buildings that's a lot of concrete and some purple carpeted stairs where you could kind of have, you know, break time with other students. Old sort of early 70s ideas about play and children.
Sometimes. Yeah, I love that you're describing your childhood in terms of the brutalist architecture and the purple carpet. Because it clearly made a big impression on you.
Well, yeah. I mean, is that kind of when you started feeling creative, like when you were in these spaces? Did you have like a really great art teacher, or were your parents really creative, or where did that even come from?
I know my mom always says I spent a lot of time in nursery school, I guess, building this farm with like animals and barns and fences and stuff. And that like apparently quite a lot of time in painting it all. So I guess I had that impulse perhaps early in the summer. Sometimes I would go see my grandmother in Germany. Me and my sister would go for like a couple months. And at some point I started to make boats to, like, she lived near one of those big public fountains in Germany where like people kind of sail, you know, they have like little model sailboats and stuff. And so I started to make weird boats, like out of, you know, coffee containers and different stuff. And I just really, really liked building those. So every summer I'd build, you know, several of them over time and take them up there and float them around and things. So that I think is not dissimilar to what I like about architectural practice now, that's kind of fun and perhaps improvised and, you know, not so much about fancy materials, but about a kind of esprit de jour or something.
Well, I mean, that must have been cool, too, getting a sample of life in Germany to go along with your upbringing in Cambridge. It sounds like you had a smorgasbord of kind of cultures to choose from.
Yeah, the countryside in Germany was really different and kind of beautiful, like these, you know, mountains with cows and cowbells. And Stuttgart, where my grandmother lived, was one of these cities that had been built new after World War II. So there was a lot of modern buildings, not a very big city, but they had sort of these different weird modern buildings that were in these big parks. Germany has a really big park culture.
I always associate post-war stuff with kind of optimism. Was there optimism built into the city?
I think so. There was a lot of emphasis on culture and the arts. The thing I remember, I don't even know who did it, sort of like a Mesian dance performance place opposite what now has the Jim Sterling Stuttgart Museum that he became really famous for. That kind of went up maybe when I was in high school or eighth grade or something, but like a little kind of culture area. And I also really liked pretzels, which is what you would call pretzels here. But that was the other big peak of my childhood, was endless supply of fresh pretzels.
That's so funny. My grandma grew up right outside of Stuttgart as well. And I went to see her hometown, which I had only seen in pictures growing up. And all I ate the entire trip was pretzels. And I remember driving down the Autobahn and seeing all those green rolling hills and thinking, oh, this is so nice and picturesque. So it's cool to like hear from somebody who grew up going there as well.
Okay, let's move on to the teenage years, because adolescence is usually marked by some pretty serious growing pains for most people. What did yours look and feel like?
Well, I lived in Cambridge, and then we moved to a small town in Michigan for a year in the late 70s.
What
Albion,
small town in
Michigan? Do you know it?
I grew up in Ypsilanti.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Tell us about your life in Albion and moving there as a teenager. What kind of transition was that like for you?
Well, it was a bit of a shock. I was only there ultimately for a year, but it was, what was interesting was it was such a different kind of a place than Cambridge, which had been, you know, let's say practically like a socialist state of, you know, liberalism. And so Albion was like a pretty impoverished town that had a bunch of glass factories and car related factories that had recently shut down. So it was kind of part of that like 70s recession America. And that also had a lot of really semi-violent like race relations, like a sort of small town, you know, this group against that group. So I sort of got more introverted there, and I got really into playing the flute and then into P.G. Woodhouse books. And I just sat around reading P.G. Woodhouse books all the time, and I created a P.G. Woodhouse lending library for my family that I don't know if anybody ever took me up on it, but I was just kind of like a pretty dorky weirdo person. And I was a mathlete as well. I believe I competed in Kalamazoo and some mathlete type stuff. So that was weird. And then I went back to Cambridge, and they did have good music though in Michigan. Like there was, I think that's when I discovered Parliament.
Yeah. So wait, where was Albion in relationship to Detroit? Was it even accessible, or was it
Detroit? My mom once took me to the Renaissance Center to see, you know, city living, but it was sort of like a couple hours from Detroit, I guess.
Yeah. Okay. So not easily accessible, definitely removed from urban life.
Yeah. Yeah. Very small, very much like the Mayberry in, you know, To Kill a Mockingbird was kind of how I saw it.
Wow. It's so interesting because that's definitely different from my experience of Michigan. But I, you know, I lived close enough and drove through towns like that to understand exactly what you're talking about. But coming from Cambridge, that must have felt like, I don't know. It sounds like you hunkered down and kind of spent your time with the flute in PG Woodhouse and just kind of waited till you could get out. Is that what you're saying?
I guess so. You know, nowadays everybody talks about the bubble and, you know, do you live in a bubble? And I certainly realized at a young age, oh yeah, I live in a, where I grew up was a super bubble. I think we all had felt that when Nixon got elected the first time, because I remember in, you know, first grade or second grade or whatever, like we all voted and everybody voted for whoever it was, McGovern, not Nixon. Like one person voted for Nixon. Then Nixon actually won. We're like, that's not democratic. How could that be? But it was just because that was the Cambridge demography, you know. So this kind of helped me change my thinking. It had a lot of beautiful things. There's like a beautiful Kalamazoo River. You could kind of like go drifting down the river in a inflatable rubber tire and stuff. But that's a complicated time, like seventh grade. And then I went back to Cambridge, and I went to this high school called Cambridge Pilot School that was part of Fringe and Latin. It's where like Matt Damon and Ben Affleck, I guess, went a couple years later. But there was only one high school for the whole town. And I think freshman year, I remember this group of kids had a cover band and they were doing Devo covers, you know, in jumpsuits out in front. And I thought that was super cool. And I was pretty happy to be in high school. So.
Yes.
I ended up managing a band in high school for a while, like a ska band. And I got into like anti-nuke stuff and set up a couple of punk shows that were, you know, the money went to anti-nuke Cambridge Students for Disarmament, I guess, was a group that a friend of mine and I started. So, yeah, so I sort of did politics and music and a lot of schoolwork.
That's cool. It's like activism, but it was kind of had a creative slant to it.
Yeah. And social, because it's sort of fun to have those
right
parties, you know, and everybody has to pay $5 or something. I kind of knew that whole time that I was going to do architecture. I'd already thought about that a little earlier. And I did an internship at this firm that had done the Boston Aquarium, which I thought was a cool building. I didn't know how to do anything, so I was more like in the slide library and stuff. But I absorbed some of the sense of this cool 70s architecture office, almost like from a lifestyle point of view. I liked that a lot. And then I did a summer program at Harvard grad school in architecture, and I loved, like, you know, doing studio work, designing stuff, and I was just super happy about that. So then I knew what I was going to do later.
So then you ended up at Harvard again to do your undergrad, right?
Yeah, and I was an art major. I did painting, but I also, again, knew all the time I was going to go into architecture. Ultimately, I did a lot of sociology and French semiotics, and just big at the time. And then I went to England for a year to this really amazing architecture school called the AA. I was a like full scholarship student. I was kind of a penniless person, and they actually let me have my scholarship to go to this other school in England, which was amazing. And
oh, that's awesome.
Such a gift. So I got to go do this like really experimental education thing for a year. And that's what ended up leading me to go to LA, because everybody in London was talking about Los Angeles as the one place in the world where you could do like really cool, interesting architecture.
Ah, that was my next question, was how did you end up, or why did you end up in LA? But that answers that question. So tell me a little bit more about your college years in LA, getting your master's.
I took a year off after college out here. I mean, I moved to LA, and then I was kind of working by day at this experimental architecture firm called Axruno, which means something like axis of uncertainty, doing like these really complicated pen and ink drawings. And then I would waitress at night. But when I got to SciArc the next fall. It was super fun. I did 3.5 years of grad school. At the time, CSIRC was still in this kind of funny, big ranging factory building with another like warehousey space behind it and all kinds of people coming through to teach there. I spent a lot of time with Mike Davis, who wrote City of Quartz, mm-hmm. kind of a historian and theorist, and some great designers and architects. And we got to put on an experimental play of Ubuwa, like as a course catalog. It was really like an art school experience, which I loved. I mean, it was so freeing because it was much less, say, academic than what I'd done as an undergrad, but also pretty rigorous in terms of the amount of, you know, work one had to produce and the idea of like making your own, you know, idea of what architecture is. Like, it wasn't very prescriptive in terms of what architecture is, and I really liked that.
Do you feel like that's where you started to find your own particular voice, or at that point are you still really just exploring everything that you can get your hands on?
I think I did. I mean, not that long ago, I was looking at my thesis project from grad school, so that's like 1992 or something, and it was in Frogtown, which is, as you mm-hmm. guys know, an area of interest these days, and it was this idea of densifying Frogtown by adding new buildings behind existing little houses, because Frogtown was a neighborhood of little kind of workmen's houses that are like 400 to 600 square feet. And then also taking over some of the old factories to make this factory where you would build the parts for these houses. So you sort of like had like an economic idea. You could kind of create jobs for the neighborhood in this place, making these kit of parts that could then become houses to densify the area, and then like a bridge over the river and stuff like that. So a lot of stuff that is stuff I still totally work on today.
Yeah, even super, like have super
a
relevant.
Couple little houses in Frogtown that I rent out because I bought some like, I don't know, 15 years ago or something. I've been working on some like changing old manufacturing buildings into other things for some different developers lately, which is kind of also as part of that thesis project.
Oh, wow. So if that thesis project was in 92 and you're still working on things that are very of that thesis project and very relevant, does it feel like that's a normal timeline for architecture, or do you feel like I'm
probably
interested? Yeah.
Well, the fact that I'm like, you know, 50, 51 and I'm considered a young architect just goes to show you architecture is a little different than, you know, reality TV or something.
Well, yeah, it does take a while to get a building realized. And it also, I mean, cities have generations and they don't change. Sometimes they change really fast, but it's layered and complex.
Yeah, and economics have a lot to do with it. So like that in 1991, 92, like we were in a big recession. You know, real estate wasn't worth that much. There wasn't the pressure of density. You know, people were moving to LA to rent an apartment for like $600 or whatever. So it was a different time. But I think the idea of what can you do with what already exists in the city, and then kind of like architecture as augmented reality in a way, which was I think part of what I was doing in my thesis, is something I'm still interested in. So it's almost more like, as opposed to needing a tabula rasa in order to build a building, how do you work with things that are here or in between them, or, you know, relate to them? Like, I'm more contextual than your average modernist bear, you know?
Okay. So let's talk about that. I mean, 92 was your thesis. You founded your studio, Bester Architecture, in 95. And I'm wondering, you know, as a young professional, just getting your studio up and running, what were some of the highlights and breakthroughs and steepest learning curves that you encountered in your early professional life?
Well, at the very beginning, I got a project. A friend of a friend was a TV, actually a couple who were TV writers, and they wanted to build a new house in the Palisades. And I had a nice introduction to them, but I also knew I didn't really have enough experience to take it on. And I got this friend of mine, Norman Millar, who was my friend for a long time and who passed away only a year ago now. So he and I joined forces and did a joint venture and then got that job together. And then we kind of opened up shop together, not as partners, but as like two entities in a joint venture. Mm-hmm. And we did a bunch of stuff together. and kind of shared this overhead. And it was like the back of a store in Los Feliz, kind of near the Dresden Room. And I was there for a long time, and it was really kind of a nice way to get started, because I was teaching. I mean, a lot of architects, when you start, you kind of balance your practice, which may not be like, you know, all is super busy with teaching gigs. And so I was teaching at UCLA for a long time, and then at SciArc, doing different kinds of projects. Somehow, what I mostly did on my own were, like, at first I got like four in a row of these kind of complicated home offices for writers, where I got to design and build all the furniture as well. Well, I didn't actually build the furniture, but like sort of design actual pieces of furniture. And mm-hmm. it got me more interested in that level of detail, you know, like a real sort of one-to-one kind of the art of craft and furniture stuff and sort of the atmosphere that you create. And, you know, most of the writers I know kind of are in there writing space a lot of time during the day. It's like they really live there. So it's kind of like a little nest. And I liked doing that. And then I got a lot more house remodel projects, and also some bigger commercial. Like I had worked a lot with this group called the Actors Gang, because mm-hmm. my ex-boyfriend wrote a bunch of plays for them, like he and Tim Robbins did all this stuff. So I ended up doing their theater when they got a permanent home on Santa Monica Boulevard. And that was challenging because it was a lot more technical, and it was taking a warehouse and building a theater inside of it involved essentially building a separate steel skeleton kind of inside. Mm-hmm. And I'm someone who always was very interested, like sort of tectonics as a major form of expression for architecture, like structure and skin and stuff. So that was very exciting, because sort of like this other layer, you know, inside the building that became the structure that held the lighting grid. And
yeah,
pretty much learned something on every project. I would say I was probably more of a hardcore modernist on most of my stuff, like through the 90s, although I guess I did these record company offices that were kind of more funky and fun. But I was the one I built a couple of new houses and stuff. They were more, you know, white. Well, they weren't white stucco, but they were like hardy panel, and they're more minimalist, let's say, in their expression. I would say I kind of turned into more of a maximalist later in life. I still go both ways, but.
Well, that's nice to know. Well, over the course of your profession, you've definitely had a real impact on the cultural identity of Los Angeles. I mean, there are experimental residences. You've rejuvenated and restored a couple of historic Lautners. You've done social media darling hospitality places like Intelligentsia Coffee, and workplaces, Beats by Dre, Snap, Nasty Gal. So you're definitely putting your stamp on Los Angeles in kind of a magical way. One recent project that I really want to talk to you about is called Blackbirds in Echo Park. And I want to hear about it in your words. But when you talked about your thesis project, Blackbirds came to mind, because it's a housing development that's also deals with urban density in an interesting way. So can you talk to us about that project?
Yeah, I love that project because, well, among other things, I spent like 5 years on it, but these developers have bought 5 adjoining lots in the hills of Echo Park, which is a very particular like ecosystem architecturally. And I lived there for a long time and knew it pretty well. The guy that they bought them from had originally compiled them and was going to build like a big box that was like 25 apartments or something. Mm-hmm. And then I think just decided to see what price he could get on the market for the land. And they decided to do a small lot subdivision, which is a LA specific code thing that was invented really to add density to neighborhoods that are smaller in scale. You know, we don't have a lot of high rise buildings here, obviously, nor do we even have that many like 4-story neighborhoods. But in a kind of multifamily neighborhood, how could you create more density without, you know, building a giant box? Mm-hmm. But the site is very complicated topographically, quite a high kind of variation from like very steep rolling hills across these 5 lots. But the goal for us was to make a sort of set of houses that are scale-wise related to what's going on in the neighborhood, but also have a kind of sense of individuality amongst them. Early on, we started out with modeling, you know, how to fit these sort of both little houses and cars onto the site. And I realized that there was this unexploited loophole in the small lot ordinance, which meant that you didn't actually have to have covered parking. So you could have your cars could just park, you know, au plein air, which is really great from a massing point of view, because one of the big things that makes a lot of new development really chunky is parking, you know, like you end up with like a 400 or 500 square foot box that just has two cars in it, which 90% of the time doesn't actually have cars in it, according to public studies. It's usually like everyone's storage or something. Mm-hmm. So we eliminate a lot of that and use the part, the middle part of it as this idea of this living street where cars could park. It's heavily landscaped during the day when the cars aren't there. You know, it's pretty low traffic, so it's sort of an okay place that kids could go, or you could also with your neighbors organize an evening and get all the cars out of the space and have an event. Mm-hmm. And so that was sort of the genesis was working around this interior parking, not parking space. Mm-hmm. And then using the streets on each side of the lots to be sort of fronts and backs to the houses that we were building. Ultimately we built 18 houses on these 5 lots. And a lot of them are masked in the way that 2 of them together look like one house. And there's another couple steps that are 3 houses that look like 2 houses. And the lie is really in the form. Like the form is a kind of asymmetrical gabled roof a lot of the time. And so in these projects, sometimes, you know, the 2 halves of the gable are the 2 different houses, and they're connected invisibly by like a plate that kind of covers up the 8 inches between them. So we called it stealth density. That it's like denser. It's a very dense project in that it's 18 instead of 5 houses, but it really only looks like about 8 houses.
Wow.
And people really like it. People like the small lot because you can buy the house outright. It's not like a condo, so you can have a typical mortgage when you're buying one of these things. So it's kind of a nice tool for densification. You know, it's still individual home ownership, but not using as much land. Big landscape agenda too in this. I mean, we worked with Mia Lair and the landscape, and that's sort of a big part of how the whole thing relates to the street.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, Clever listeners, we're getting excited for New York Design Week in May. This year will be better than ever. ICFF, North America's leading platform for contemporary design, will take place from May 19th to the 21st at the Javits Center in New York City. I'll be there, and I'm excited to let you know how Clever is collaborating with ICFF for Launchpad at Wanted, formerly known as Wanted Design Manhattan, and the Emerging Designer Showcase. Launchpad is an international platform for emerging designers that introduces new concepts and showcases prototypes of furniture, home accessories, and lighting. It is the best place for manufacturers to meet new designers, discover fresh ideas, and potential products to develop. The Best of Launchpad winners will be selected by a jury of renowned industry professionals, led by yours truly. And they will go on to be featured in another edition of the popular Emerging Designers Showcase. I'll be leading the Emerging Designers Showcase live on the Talks main stage, where the 5 Launchpad finalists will have a chance to present their projects to our esteemed panel of professionals. It's always a really good time. So mark your calendars for Sunday, May 19th at 4 p.m. Both Launchpad and the Emerging Designer Showcase are presented with media partners Clever, that's us, and Design Milk, and with support from American Standard and Lumens. Visit ICFF.com to learn more and register to attend. Those are the letters ICFF.com. Come by and say hi. I would love to see you there.
Support for Clever comes from Wix Studio. Instead of reading you another, let's be honest, boring ad script, Wix Studio just sent me this wild-looking Alice in Wonderland-themed website to scroll through and tell you about. So, whoa. This is not the web I'm used to. There's something called mouse parallax, which makes it feel like you can go deeper into the screen. And as I scroll down, it's like I'm falling down the rabbit hole. And things are moving in depth and perspective. Even my cursor has morphed into a glowing little orb. There are all these no-code animations that make this place feel organic and alive. And Alice is wearing some pretty cool shoes, by the way. Okay, I know I'm mixing up my narratives now, but we are definitely not in Kansas anymore. Your turn to go down the rabbit hole. Build your next web project on Wix Studio, the platform for agencies and enterprises.
That's one of the things that I appreciate about it. You kind of figured out how to work with the scale of the neighborhood, create a denser living situation, but you also incorporated the landscape as part of the program, which is nice. And it's nice for the people who live there, too.
Yeah, no, but my favorite thing was that I got invited a few months ago to a dinner party that eight of the houses had together in the middle courtyard. So they had set up all these big tables and had a big potluck dinner in the middle. And it was just super exciting because it was like a, you know, as architects, we really want to create community amongst humans. And I was like, oh, I got community.
Success.
You said at the beginning, you love people. So community and people. That's the same thing.
I also want to talk about another recent project, which is a little bit different. It's not residential, but Ashes and Diamonds Winery in Napa, which deals with a different set of challenges. So can you tell us a little bit about that project as well?
Oh, yeah. Ashes and Diamonds. The client on that is this guy, Kashi Kaledi, who I sort of knew from back in the day working on, I did some space for the Beastie Boys, their record company, Grand Royal, and their magazine, and Kashi used to work on that. And he was opening a new winery in Napa that was, he specifically wanted to make it kind of for a younger generation of wine people, and also kind of contrary to the general trends in Napa Valley, a winery that was really celebrating its Californianess and kind of Americanness in terms of design. There's a lot of, you know, neo-Renaissance, neo-whatever kind of wineries in Napa. And so I thought that was kind of a thrilling idea. Like, so it's sort of, it's like a little bit meta about California modernism, this building. And I had been working on this show about Albert Frey and Lena Bobardi for the Palm Springs Museum at the time. So I'd really been steeped in some Palm Springs language. And one of the ideas was to make this winery, which is set back from the main road quite a bit, was to try and make part of it at least a sign for the winery itself. You know, you can't really do signage per se in Napa Valley. But so I ended up doing this folded roof that is essentially a big shade structure over the hospitality building. And that folded roof is almost like a Wexler house or something like that in Palm Springs, but like much more exaggerated and oversized. And then below it is this very simple volume with a lot of glass and a wood interior that's kind of like a, like also like a supersized Palm Springs house in that it's, well, I'll not say Palm Springs, like a case study house, but it's kind of like, it's not the same scale, but it's a sort of really big room. And you get that, we were able to sort of play with some of the tropes of post-war optimistic modernism in terms of how that whole hospitality space worked. We also got to do the landscape. So we sort of took all the excavations that were done for the foundations and used them to make these mounds in the back that give a little bit of a rolling hills landscape that you can kind of sit in to watch projections on the wall of the factory building at night. And even the factory itself, we were able to sort of manipulate the skin of it. It's like a prefab type metal building shed with, you know, full on crush pad and wine vats on the inside, but the outside facing sort of public facing side is more articulated and has these circular windows and this flat wall that you can project movies onto and stuff. So it's a very outdoor living sort of celebration kind of California. I'm very excited about it. It only opened in October and we're kind of waiting for the landscape to grow in
Oh, I'm excited to visit. I'm up there quite a bit. So.
Oh, good. Well, the wine's really wonderful, too.
So continuing to talk about your creative process, as I was, doing some research, a few phrases kept reappearing in your visual language, and they are sunshine versus smog, strange beauty, and atmospheric urbanism. So I want to get your take on what those all mean. Let's start with sunshine versus smog. What do you mean by that?
Well, that I like to use it to describe kind of Southern California culture, I guess, a way of setting it up as a kind of like an AC-DC current, you know, behind mm-hmm. the city. And so an example would be, you know, optimistic indoor-outdoor living glass houses versus film noir, you know, kind of Chinatown shadows made out of shaded Venetian blinds and, you know, dark deeds happening on brightly lit suburban streets. So there's a kind of, that would be like the noir side, I guess. And there was a wonderful show at the Hammer Museum ages ago, I think called Sunshine Noir. And it was sort of a German curator's idea of California art mm-hmm. in the 80s and 90s. And that double value that you see like in B movies or in other kinds of, you know, more mainstream culture, I think keeps persisting. And really for us architects, there was this very important movement in the 70s and 80s called the LA School, which is sort of when Frank Gehry became a bigger figure in Morphosis and Eric Von Moss. And I think it's David Gissen, who's a architecture historian professor, describes that as a kind of smog era in LA architecture. So, you know, after, say, the glass houses of case study modernism, there's this sort of counter movement that is more like a kind of punk rock deconstructivist, et cetera, movement, which is really what LA became very famous for in the later 20th century. And that's also sort of under the rubric of smog, I think. So mm-hmm. I guess for architecture wise, I kind of look at it as, yeah, sort of a, you know, the Pierre Koenig versus the Frank Gehry kind of back and forth in terms of our architectural sort of history and culture that we operate in. I don't think people always think about it that way, but you're kind of in this zone of, you know, which kind of experimentalism is it? High modernist or is it postmodernist? And that seems to be an ongoing issue for a lot of us in especially design-oriented offices today.
So what about this idea of strange beauty?
Well, I came up with this motto, kind of was trying to get like a, you know, what is it that we're doing here statement together for the office. And I came up with this idea that everybody should experience strange beauty every day. And it's a hybrid of concepts, one of them being the Russian formalist idea that art is making strange, that sometimes just by decontextualizing something like, you know, a public bathroom that suddenly has this really beautiful, you know, piece of faucet in or something like that. Like you can kind of create these aha moments in your day that make you feel more alive in a way. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But also the everyday thing that even the more mundane projects or, you know, street corners can be kind of, you can have these moments and that's something that is architecture's role. It's sort of what's behind the weird range of projects that we have, that they often like the workspaces are in a sense urban design projects. You know, you might have like 500 people in this office space and how are you creating all these different touch points for them during the day that aren't just the regular old desk that they sit at, but the other stuff that they can do and where they see other people.
How does atmospheric urbanism come into all this? Can you talk about what that is?
Atmospheric urbanism is thinking about how you can create sometimes architectural experience without having all three dimensions to work with. And it certainly applies a lot when you're looking at a city like LA, where a lot of the city is getting recycled and not necessarily like torn down and replaced, but you're reoccupying places that were something else before and now they're a new thing.
Yeah.
And so
have all these chapters still. Yeah.
And you want to keep those and you want to add to it. But mm-hmm. sometimes even just because of, you know, how budgets work, sometimes all you really have is the two-dimensional palette. And I think that you can do a lot to create an atmosphere by doing things like paint colors and graphics and some materiality, you know, in a given space to really have that feel a very particular way, as opposed to like an adjacent space that may be a similarly sized and lit space, but you can make that feel very different as well. So it's a little bit using the tools of scenography. One could say that, you know, the sort of tile thing that we started doing back 10 years ago at Intelligentsia is part of that, where you suddenly have this pattern that kind of travels mm-hmm. from outside to inside and up the counter. Mm-hmm. But also certainly in the workspaces where we have these really big volumes and big spaces, and we really try to bring a lot of color in and, you know, creative use of subtle graphics and wallpapers and stuff like that to make that space more human friendly. So like we just did a project for Snap where we took a building that used to be the Museum of Flying in Santa Monica near the airport. And then later on, it was an Audi showroom / engineering workshop. And then we turned it into an office for a lot of people. And we brought a lot of natural elements in. A lot of them were artificial natural elements. Like we created a wallpaper based on leaves that travels through a lot of the public spaces. And it really changes the way, you know, you experience that space. It doesn't have a lot of natural light necessarily. So often we had to create these things that sort of felt lighter than the space actually was. And I think if you think of it in terms of atmosphere, it's out of the typical, let's say, architectural toolkit of plan and section. But the idea that there's all these other layers that we have at our disposal as designers to really, you know, create specificity in space is a very particular kind of atmosphere, like a choice.
And it must be kind of fun for you, too, to be able to see a project through to the finishing details, to be able to conceive of that at the outset and then have that be part of the finished design. All right. So, Barbara, we're going to shift gears a little bit to your personal life. I did want to ask you about something that I think all of our listeners could benefit from your take on. You gave a TED Talk and you were pretty candid about how going through a painful divorce may have helped open the doors to new ways of working. I'm just kind of interested now that it's in the rearview mirror a little bit and you have some hindsight on the whole chapter. I'm wondering what advice you might give fellow creatives about embracing the rawness of life and what it might hold for you.
Well, one thing that I found helpful through that journey, I guess, was Jung, Carl Jung, who very, very conveniently like posits that not only is, you know, early childhood really important, like it is for Freud, but for Jung, there's this whole midlife part that's also really important. One of the things I had gotten out of reading some Jung, which happened like when I got divorced and I was searching around for like midlife crisis material, was finding out that the midlife crisis is considered sometimes an incredibly important opportunity for personal growth, which is not something you necessarily think of in, you know, people driving red sports car type midlife crisis. Mm. And so for me, that actually was true, because I think something that maybe isn't uncommon in architects is that we like rules and we live by a lot of rules and we create even more complicated rules to live by or design by. And I certainly have been a very rule, like I liked sort of rules and structures. I was really just sort of detached suddenly from this whole kind of rule set that I had set up for myself. And one of the things I started to do was almost revert back to like my mindset when I was in college, when everything was sort of open ended and I had thought about going to grad school for art. Uh-huh. Just kind of, you know, just cutting loose from all the rules. But then I ended up building this house for myself and my daughters, because I was sort of single momming there for the first year or so. And I really had such a good time building this house. And then I got some other project too. And I was like, no, I actually really like architecture, especially because I was doing it more, let's say, flying by the seat of my pants. Like I just wasn't following the rules. I was just doing whatever I felt like, which in that case, sorry, there's a police car outside my window. In that case,
it's because you weren't following the rules.
I know. The cops. So, you know, in the past, all the houses I had built had, you know, flat roof and kind of metal windows and a very, you know, it wasn't about color. They were really just sort of experiments in very minimal structures. And I ended up getting this weird house that had this gable roof and I kind of exaggerated it. I kind of got into the whole thing. Like it was almost like a fun like set maybe for me and my daughters to live this sort of idyllic life together. And I did a huge garden, which I'd never done before, with my friend Stephanie Bartron. And anyway, it just ended up being a really positive experience. And it also got like published like crazy weirdly, because all this other stuff I've been trying to get published forever. Everyone's like, yeah, it kind of looks, you know, like Dwell. I don't know. And so I had this really unusual, like outlier house, and it was good. So it sort of helped me get into another stage of work where I was really more interested in pleasure and expression than I had for a long time, which is part of what got me into architecture in the first place, to be honest. I really loved like a lot of kooky, like I loved Alvar Aalto and some of the crazy Japanese architects from the 80s when I first got into architecture. And so it kind of got me back in touch with like what I loved about this profession in the first place, which is sort of inventive making of things and, you know, playing around with spaces. So that, and then I did a book because of that house. I got this great book contract, and I did a whole book about living in Silver Lake and Bohemian modernism. So it was really good. I would say that even though it was probably the worst thing that happened to me at that time, just being set loose like that ended up allowing me to like grow by kind of rebuilding both my identity and my attachment and my vocation in a kind of open-ended way. It was also very fortunate that I was able to have that freedom. In the end, I wouldn't change it for the world, which is, you know, not what I would have said back then.
Right. Sometimes the universe actually has to kind of crack your shell and force you to divest of things that aren't serving you. And it's usually pretty painful when that happens.
Yeah. I like the word liminality, like you're no longer attached to your persona or whatever that you have created. The Jungian argument, which I think is, for me anyhow, is true, is that you kind of come up with the idea of who you're going to be as an adult when you're a teenager, and you sort of set about doing that. And I definitely did that. Like I kind of had this, you know, I don't know, Leonardo da Vinci meets Alvar Aalto meets like Eight is Enough, like living in California, being architect. And I kind of did all that, and then everything like fell apart, and I was like, oh, like wait a minute. Okay, so who am I actually after all this time has passed, you know? And I had to kind of reevaluate. But in the end, that ended up being very, yeah, creatively a very good thing.
You mentioned two kids. So I want to know, I guess, like when you were talking about your childhood and how you mentioned a lot of the buildings around you and your relationships or your experiences within those buildings, I'm wondering, like, what do you hope that the built world can give your kids, not only the experiences that they have within the architecture that you've actually created yourself, like your home and other spaces around Los Angeles, but like all architecture? I am also wondering, like, how you see that evolving to actually support the next generation who's going to be living with this architecture.
Both my kids are kind of activists in different communities. One of them's been doing some stuff on homelessness and like homeless women and girls. And they're looking at the parts of the like problematic things happening in the city as it changes that are, you know, let's say the voices of the less heard people in the city. And they asked me sometimes, like, well, what are you doing about this, you know, as an architect? And it's, you know, I'm like, ah, this is a good question. Like, I, you know, a lot of the economics behind building are not in architects' hands, you know, but at the same time, how do you come up with new proposals? In my case, I'm kind of interested in like, where can we put a lot more housing? You know, where can we be opportunistic that doesn't necessarily turn into like a NIMBY nightmare, but is also like helps create the urban density that I think is really healthy for people, you know, to be able to walk around and see a lot of other people. It's like a really good thing. Generally, I'm not big on isolated suburbs. Mm-hmm. So I guess for them, I think that next generation is really going to be looking at a city that might go from, you know, where we're 15 or 18 million to like 24 million or something, like a whole lot more people without any more space necessarily, because I don't think anyone's going to be moving to Palmdale anymore. So how do they navigate that new sort of densification? And it's interesting because I think what's great is that they don't have the baggage of a kind of nostalgia for the LA of the 1950s or 60s, which a lot of older generation people do. Like when I got here in the late 80s and 90s, you know, it was really economically depressed. Everybody could buy a house for like a dollar. And it was very much that single family house texture, which is starting to change a lot. Mm-hmm. But they don't have that same nostalgia because they haven't really seen it. They haven't grown up in a city that was like that. It was already under a lot of change. So I think, you know, is it going to be a Tokyo model or a New York model or some Mexico City model or something else entirely that I think is going to be in that generation's hands to some degree? I don't think they're going to be, I think they're going to be more YIMBY than NIMBY, which I think is a good thing.
I don't know what that means.
Oh, okay. So YIMBY is the yes in my backyard as opposed to not in my backyard. So San Francisco has a very active well, San Francisco has an activist group called YIMBYs, you know, that is, you know, like there's a much greater housing crisis in San Francisco and the tech corridor. And but San Francisco also has a huge anti-development contingent of like an older generation that has, you know, a lot invested in their Victorian houses and stuff. So don't want to see any new construction. So the YIMBY people have started showing up at planning hearings in support of anything, even the ugliest project in the world, because they're like, we don't care. We just need more housing. So we're going to show up at these things and not, you know, not just let it be dominated by the naysayers. And LA is starting to have a little bit of that as well. It's just, it's more nascent movement here.
Yeah. Yeah. It will be interesting how it'll be forced to change to accommodate the influx of people. And hopefully it's done so in a thoughtful and meaningful way as opposed to a haphazard way, which isn't really, is to say that it, you know, not thought has gone in on the front end to figure out how to create these spaces and communities and neighborhoods that can really support growth.
Yeah. And I mean, so much, I mean, just in the time that I've been here, which is a while now, but you know, there was like no public transportation infrastructure to speak of other than some buses.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was no electric vehicles and I mean, a lot, there's no Uber and Lyft. And I mean, all these things are really changing the way people navigate the city. There's no bike lanes. I spent some time in Copenhagen recently with one of my daughters and it was so amazing. And they did like a Milton, you must bicycle everywhere kind of policy. I think they made cars there are like, you know, $150,000. So nobody really has a car because of taxes or something. So really like everybody bicycles in the dead of winter in Copenhagen, which is, you know, kind of bananas, but you can see, you see what like a stronger stance by the city can do. Like you can do a lot if you're willing to muscle up on the government side or on the regional side. And that's one of the big tests coming up. Like, are there going to be activists urging the city to do better? I mean, I think internally, you know, the Christopher Hawthorne, Eric Garcetti thing seems like that's going to be a positive push, but
keeping my eye on that. I have high hopes.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So let's look at you and your future. You have a lot of accomplishments under your belt already, and you've got a family and you've got your midlife crisis already behind you. So
I hope.
What do you have to look forward to in terms of personal growth? Like, what's one thing you hope to learn?
Well, that's interesting. I guess I am super obsessed with the 2028 Olympics, and I got like two people working on like ideas for the Olympics just so that I can have like a grab bag full of ideas to kind of throw out there as we move towards it. Because I think, you know, for in 1984 when LA had the Olympics, it was a really big moment for LA design and architecture. And I worked on this on Deborah Sussman, who designed the LA Olympics back then, and I did a show about her. And it was funny because it was a little bit like, hey, my dad has a barn, let's put on a show. It was like a fast, you know, we got to come up with a graphic identity, we got to come up with a color palette, we're gonna make a million things out of paper and sprinkle them all over the city. And then you have like this week of people walking around, there's all these like sauna tubes painted cool colors and scaffolding with flags on it, the real like temporal city explosion. And I think that kind of work is, you know, what would that be now? Is it really interesting? I mean, now we have, you know, public transportation, so we have a lot more places to kind of catch people and, you know, get them excited. But I think it's a great sort of possible project for art people and architecture people in different communities in LA to like collaborate on. Like, how do we want to show ourselves to the world if we're going to be like the most diverse and pioneering city in a somewhat conservative America. Mm-hmm. What story are we telling, you know? And sometimes these things are a little more like, you know, the Oscar show, like a more kind of corporatized thing. But we have so much time before the LA Olympics that I think there's a way to really get a lot more voices into it. And so I'm pretty interested in that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So I would love to know, like, what do you want long term? Like, are you thinking your studio will continue to grow? Is there a particular project that you just, like, down the road really want to do that you've never worked on before? Are there any other big issues in the future that you want to tackle? What's, like, the long term picture here?
Well, I go back and forth. For a long time, I have been very just interested in the city and its changing and growth. And for me, anyhow, how do you sort of like some legacy projects that are, you know, actually like useful as an example of how to do something like the Black Birch thing. You know, I invested a lot of my own time into that just to kind of get a good project out there that would appeal to people that aren't, you know, just architects, but as a kind of a like, oh yeah, actually, this is actually a nice, you know, I could live here. Like, you know, kind of not demystifies, but destigmatizes density. Mm-hmm. I am really interested in housing. I mean, I guess I think I'm kind of good at it just from having done all these different kinds of projects like that. So I've been looking at some areas where I think it could kind of rezone and add housing that could be really interesting along the LA River. And it's tricky though. Land's really expensive here now. So it's, you know, it's easier if there's just tons of cheap land and developers are like, woohoo. And right now I think the development community and the political community and the neighborhood communities are all sort of wary of each other. And, you know, there isn't as much going on as there certainly could be.
Yeah.
So the LA Design Festival is happening, coming up. Do you have anything going on during that time or any projects that you want to point out in particular that our listeners should look up, go to and visit, get involved in some way?
An interesting project for the Senior Community Center that's kind of like a hypothetical project that is over on Riverside Drive in Los Feliz near the fountain. And that's a cool one that I was going to try and publish soon. It'll end up being a private-public partnership. It's on some existing land that the Parks Department owns. I guess that's one to look out for if it ends up, you know, in curved or something.
Does it have a name?
Well, it's not very memorable. It's GPAC, which is like the Griffith Park Adult Community Center. Okay. I guess I should probably give it our project a name. And then I think that the Silver Lake Conservatory of Music is a really great one to see. It's in Los Feliz on Hollywood Boulevard near Vermont. And they have these really great music programs, even for adults, like they have adult choir. But the space has a kind of informal, like street-facing lobby hangout space. And then it has this kind of more radical little world of rehearsal rooms in the middle, built around like a disco ball that houses the big bathrooms, weirdly, and then it's a big assembly place at the back. But that's a good one to look out for events and concerts that I'm super proud of. That's kind of like a bigger size project for us on the urban scale.
Cool. Yes. And that Silver Lake Conservatory of Music, that's new, but the actual conservatory has been around for a long time. So this means it's growing and it's growing into a new, bigger space. That's awesome.
Yeah, I think they now have 50% of their classes are free for kids who can't afford to take them. And then they're subsidized by the other 50%. So it's kind of like providing the music education that's been, you know, value engineered out of the schools.
Yeah, that's really wonderful.
I guess I should say it's, you know, Flea of the Red Hot Chili Peppers is the person who started the conservatory and is kind of the main cheerleader and ringleader of that whole thing. So it was fun to, you know, work with him, and he got a lot of people in the music world to help contribute so they could grow and move into this new space.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Well, I would love to direct our listeners to find you, follow you, read all about what you're doing. So can you give us your web address and then any social media handles you have?
Oh, sure. Yeah. The web address is besterarchitecture.com, and that has all of our projects. And Instagram, I have two. I have @besterarchitecture, which is sort of the official office one. And then I have my own one, which is just @BarbaraBester. And I think I'm also on Twitter @BarbaraBester, but I'm more of an Instagrammer than a Twitterer.
Well, thank you so much. This has been really enlightening, and I appreciate you sharing all of your thoughts and philosophies with us.
Thank you guys so much. Yeah. It was great to talk to you guys. I really appreciate your taking the time.
Have a great day. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
She's a pretty phenomenal person.
I mean, she's doing so much for LA. I mean, she's like transforming it.
I love that she's really excited to wrap her head around the density issue and come up with some solutions. You know, I live here and I see a lot of condo and apartment buildings going up, and they all feel like more of the same, with just maybe a modern stucco coat on the outside, you know, but they don't really feel like they're rethinking any of the standard problems that come up with that. And so I like that she is. I love that she's thinking about the Olympics and that that's really exciting to her. And she's like figuring out all the kinds of ways that like different creatives can collaborate on this explosion of temporal stuff in the city. That sounds so fun.
I know. When is that happening?
2028.
So she's got some time.
Well, yeah, but you know,
yes and no.
That,
architecture, yeah. It takes a while to get anything done. Yeah, but I agree with you about the density issue. As we've talked to quite a few people, they've mentioned the growing population of the entire world, of course, but, you know, large cities like LA are obviously going to be impacted the most with growth. And as it is, LA is sprawling, it's spread out, it's hard to get around. So, you know, we need people like Barbara Bester thinking about housing, but also thinking about the communities and how people can continue interacting in their spaces and can get from point A to point B and live their lives in a more efficient way without feeling like they're crammed for space or like they don't have privacy. I don't know. Like, I like that she's thinking about that. And we need more people to be doing that right now.
One of the things about her talk that really affected me was the idea of all these residents getting together and inviting her to a dinner party on their shared yard space. Because I think about some of these apartment buildings and condos, and you end up being fairly anonymous. You maybe run into your neighbors in the hallway. All the shared space doesn't really feel that communal, as much as you end up feeling a little bit like you're on display if you use it, you know? But the fact that they're inviting her to a dinner party there means that she's actually been really successful at creating some sort of communal area that actually does support community building.
Right. Right. Yeah. There's ways you could do that, like you said, in a way that doesn't really make people feel comfortable or, you know, communal, really. It just feels like you're in this wide open space where everybody can watch you doing things. Yeah. Or you're in a space that doesn't facilitate interaction between you and your neighbors, and the only place that that happens is in the communal space, which I don't necessarily think is the best way either. You know, I've lived in many apartment buildings in my lifetime and have had like zero interaction with my neighbors.
Right, except for like banging the broom on the ceiling when they're too
loud. Yeah, or like hold the elevator. You know? Like, yeah. Okay, hi, how are you? Like, oh, you've been living next to me for 3 years. Like, oh, nice to meet you. Yeah, I love that, and it's super important as we go forward because there's going to be so many more people.
I guess I'm not surprised she brought Jung into the whole conversation. Jung, Carl Jung. What do you call him? A philosopher? A psychiatrist?
Was he a psychoanalyst?
I think he's a psychoanalyst, yes. But I really appreciated her illustrating that the midlife crisis is not something to necessarily be mocked and avoided, that it's actually a really great opportunity for personal growth, which for her it was. Mm-hmm. But mostly she described it as like shedding all these rules she had created for herself and going back to some of the more free creativity that she remembers from her youth and having a lot of fun with that. And that
set the stage for her sort of growing into who she's supposed to be, as opposed to this like preformed idea of who she thought she'd be that she was adhering to.
I think we all
kind of try to manipulate our identities when we're young, and we have these ideas of who we're supposed to be and how that person is going to satisfy all the requirements that our parents set out for us, that we feel like would satisfy our place in society. And frequently we just have to figure out, like, that suit doesn't fit, man. It doesn't fit.
Well, sometimes it's like you get, so I guess a good way to think of it too is like when you're younger and you picture like how your life is going to be and what you're going to do when you get older and blah, blah, blah. And you have all these boxes that you want to check. As you check those boxes, you know, and as you get older, you get to a point where you check all of those boxes, right? But like when you're in your 20s or your teens or even like younger, like 40 seems like old. But once you get to 40 and you've checked all those boxes, you're like, oh my God, I still have half my life left. Like, I'm not dead yet. So what do you do now? Like, once you've checked all those boxes, and like, that's kind of, I think, what some people get to where they're kind of trying to figure out what their next thing is, like whether or not they want to stay doing what they're doing for the rest of their life, or, you know, they need to shake things up and find something else, or they go through a really like crazy life experience, like having kids or getting a divorce, or, you know, maybe they lose their job and they start a new career. All kinds of things can happen as you get older. It's just trying to figure out how to navigate that toward happiness and contentment.
Well, and so frequently checking off those boxes provides a different sort of sense of fulfillment than you thought it would, right? I'm just saying that, like, a lot of times you can check off those damn boxes and then you're like, oh, okay, but that's not what life is about. But right. I got my checklist accomplished.
Yeah. Like, oh, you know, I became a doctor or whatever, and I make X amount of dollars a year, and that's what I wanted to do. And now I'm here, and I'm like, oh, it doesn't feel, you know, satisfying, or I don't feel accomplished, or it's not bringing me the happiness they thought it would bring me. Or maybe it does, but it's, you know, but as time goes on, it doesn't anymore. Because we all are constantly changing and evolving.
Hopefully. That's the only thing that's constant, right?
Right.
Is change.
It's true.
Hey, everybody. Thank you for listening. Please remember to subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts. And then you can find us wherever you get your podcasts. You can even ask Siri or Alexa or your mom. You should probably tell your mom about Clever Podcast. I think she'd enjoy us, don't you, Jamie?
Yeah, definitely.
And then go to cleverpodcast.com to sign up for our newsletter, read the show notes, and see images of Barbara's work, which is totally cool.
And you can also connect with us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Clever Podcast. We read every single comment, retweet. We make sure to be happy when we get a like. We're just really happy to engage with you guys online. And this episode of Clever was edited by Ty Navaris and Alex Perez, with music by L1011.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.